From WXXI News, it's Innovation Friday on Connections. I'm Frank Sigelski, and this hour on Connections Innovation Friday, we're going to start with a couple gentlemen from the Xerox Research Center in Webster talking about the things that they're doing in the area of transportation, driverless cars, drone research, and it's, a lot of it's happening right here in our own backyard. And then the second half of the hour, we're going to be speaking with Stephen Butler from Engage CNY to talk about a regional cultural plan to reposition the arts. But let's start with our guests who are in studio here. We have Peter Paul, who is a PhD, and also,
Ken Maheloff.
Thank you very much.
Both, of course, that's Chief Innovation. Now, you're Chief Innovation Officer. We should have had you here in the last half hour, Ken, because we're talking all about innovation. But I'm sure we'll get to it now as well. Frank, you might, just a bit of context is across Innovation Fridays, we've been talking a lot about transport in different transport, urban design, and so on. And this is kind of why I was interested to get our guest today in as well. So I guess, you know, in terms of what's the capacity for, you know, the extent of research and development that's going on at the campus, you know, that's going on at the Webster campus for Xerox at the moment. Maybe, Peter, you could kick it off.
Sure. You know, the Rochester area has a long history of expertise and competency in imaging systems, you know, the major companies, in particular Xerox. So we're leveraging that expertise in computer vision and imaging systems beyond the traditional Xerox markets of printers and copiers to other things like transportation. So that's one area. Another area is analytics in general and social media analysis. So those are three areas of research that the research center is focused on.
And these are kind of key segments in the market where Xerox is obviously trying to reposition, you know, leverage your existing, you know, expertise and patents and technologies into areas that are more diversified than the legacy industry.
So absolutely. And through an acquisition 4 years ago, we are now involved in the services businesses, and it's a quite varied number of businesses: transportation, healthcare, education, financial services, and those technologies can be applied in those new business areas.
Right. So transport. So maybe Ken, you want to chime in here and just talk about, I guess, transport as a kind of an area of interest, you know, and how you sort of envisaged, you know, channeling the technology that you already had within the organization into this particular area.
Sure. So transportation part of the business when we first acquired Affiliated Computer Services, as Peter mentioned before, it was probably the first part of the business that we engaged seriously with our research skills. And we worked with them to try and identify the places where those skills could be applied for their business. We've done some things, as Peter mentioned, around computer vision systems, license plate recognition technology. So now Xerox has a launched offering around license plate recognition where you can capture an image of a license plate, extract the information that tells you not only the license plate but which state and so on. And we've just recently announced the launch of a vehicle occupancy detection capability.
Right.
Those are two examples of taking the kind of skills that Peter mentioned before and applying them to this new field of transportation for Xerox.
And so that's to determine how many people are in a vehicle. So if you're in the
Correct.
HOV lane and you've got a blow-up dummy in the passenger seat, your service or product will say that you should be in a different lane?
Well, the idea, there's two applications for this. One is a high-occupancy vehicle lane, and in which case you're supposed to have a certain number of occupants in the vehicle. And this will help enforcement of those high-occupancy vehicle lanes, where today it's very difficult to enforce it. But there's also the notion of high-occupancy toll lanes. There, you may not have the right number of occupants in order to be in that lane, but if you want to pay an extra charge, you're allowed to participate anyway. And so this helps enforce and enact the tolling process as well.
And that's sort of like a sliding scale. The more crowded the highway is at that particular time, the more they're going to charge you, not dissimilar from the parking applications that you guys have helped develop. In other words, where's a parking space? How much will it cost? Do I want to walk a little bit further? That's all part of the same parcel of things?
Absolutely. So these sort of dynamic incentives to customers to maintain, for example, in the high occupancy tolling lane, the idea is to always maintain at least 45 miles per hour in that lane. If you think of very congested roadways, let's say in the Los Angeles area, where you want to avoid gridlock, the idea is to adjust that toll charge to maintain 45 miles per hour at all times. Similarly, you mentioned parking, the same kind of concept. The idea is to always have parking spaces available to those who are willing to pay the charge.
Right, right. And maximizing revenues, Matt?
Well, so I can see, obviously, clearly see the interest of law enforcement in that package. But I guess just inverting it a little bit, also, you know, obviously as, you know, major metropolitan cities, you know, decide to come up with strategies to deal with congestion, I assume that's kind of an application that you can also see in terms of being able to, you know, find ways to sort of regulate or provide information flow about that, both to drivers and to, you know, traffic control systems, et cetera.
So for parking, some of the statistics are amazing. In major metropolitan areas, 30% of all traffic is people driving around looking for parking spaces.
Right. But 30%?
30%, 30%,
30. Right.
Which I'm flabbergasted.
Yeah.
We were too.
Right.
Wow. More to follow up on that? Or?
Sure, yeah. And, you know, agencies and actually the federal government are looking at high occupancy tolling lanes as a way to reduce congestion. We talked about the dynamic incentives involved there. You know, one thing about it that, you know, I grew up in the Rochester area and I never knew this, but you know, we use the New York State Thruway and the Easy Pass. Everyone loves it. You get on, you don't have to stop. Well, through this acquisition now, Xerox has 50% of the electronic tolling collection in the United States. And in fact, we have the back office and run basically the Easy Pass system in the Northeast.
Right. Okay. If that isn't an incentive for people to call in, I don't know what is.
Yes, exactly.
get to the phones now.
Yes, get to the phones at 844-295-TALK. Yeah. Maybe there's some inside information there. 1-844-295-8255 if you want to join the conversation. What about privacy concerns? We talked about that before going on the air here. I don't want anyone to know how many people I have in my car.
Well, then you already are declaring how many people you have in your car by using that high occupancy lane in theory. And, you know, probably everyone's driven on carpool lanes in Toronto or New York City. And, you know, you sort of get fed up if the lane is not enforced properly. If people are driving by, they're not adhering to the rules of the carpool lane. The system that we've just announced, privacy was designed in from the start. No image is taken of people that is saved that's not redacted, and only images of violators are saved in the system. So privacy was designed in from the start. You know, in today's society, there's sort of security cameras all over the place and sort of it's hard to avoid. But we intentionally designed in privacy from the beginning.
Do you then NPR ran a story this week about license plate recognition technology, I think, between two states in the Dakotas, where they wouldn't share information, where they were actually trying to enforce license plate recognition speeding fines on one side of the county, and then the next city wouldn't share that information, and so on. So you're also getting into some. There's another sort of layer to this, which has to do with, I guess, you know, mechanisms for information sharing across authorities and those kinds of things. Is that something you're trying to factor into your thinking or planning around, you know, how the information flows are going to work?
Sure, absolutely. And, you know, one thing you talk about information flows, that really leads to the natural question of analytics and optimizing the design of highway systems. You know, no one wants to get stopped in gridlock traffic. And so more information about where traffic is flowing and, you know, what's used more, what's used less, time of day, response to weather. These are all things that can be learned through analytics.
Right. So I think, I mean, I guess, Ken, you know, a lot of people, you know, some people might have an app on their, you know, smartphone with Google, which has traffic flow information on their Google Maps, and they're saying, okay, that looks bad that way, let's take this route. I mean, to what level do you think realistically the research can take that kind of level of information, real-time information, back to users, you know, to perhaps kind of support reducing congestion levels?
I think it's already happening. If you've ever use the app Waze, you'll see already in there that there's a lot of feedback from travelers on the road already telling you that there's an accident on the right shoulder coming up or there's a policeman coming up. It will reroute you in real time. So those things are coming. In some cases, they're already here like that. I think there's a lot of opportunity for at least near real time. Real time is a, you know, instantaneous is hard to achieve.
Right. But so it's a relative term. Real time is a relative term.
It's a real right, a relative term, but right. Near real time is starting to show up, and I think we'll see more and more of that.
But a lot of that information, correct me if I'm wrong, that's sort of user-generated, so it's actually coming from other users
in that
particular who are presumably
case.
Texting while they're driving in order to be able to send this information.
Well, hopefully what they're doing is they're so gridlocked that they're stopped in traffic right. And they're not using their phone while they're driving.
Or they're waiting for one of Governor Cuomo's tech stops to come up in 5 miles so they can do it. But but what about the role of sensors? Because I think sensor journalism is something that we're really interested in as well. Could you talk a little bit about the role of things that are actually able to detect conditions and send that as a data stream rather than as user input?
So I would start again with the parking example. I think here some of the work that we've done required that a particular tank sensor is emplaced in the road for each parking spot that we were trying to collect data on. And that gives you a very good indication of either occupied or unoccupied parking spaces.
Right.
And you can provide that information up to a user to let them know where spaces are available. But it's also fairly expensive. And so part of what we've been looking at are other techniques to be able to, again, use a video camera perhaps to look over a broader space to give that same kind of parking information, occupancy information, but at a little bit less expensive approach.
Right. And not on a space-by-space, but more of a general. It looks like the third floor of the municipal garage has got some spaces. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, in some cases, if it's on-street parking, it would be space-by-space.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about that. We've certainly talked about some other kinds of applications for parking lots or garages or so forth. And in some cases, you may not need to know exactly which space, but you need to know, perhaps want to count cars. You know how many spaces are in that particular lot. You can count how many cars come in, how many cars come out.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, without giving exactly which space is available, that you have some spaces that you could offer. So it depends on the application.
And, with some of the technology we're working on, particularly for on-street parking, we can have more creative rates in terms of charging the customers, maybe based on how much space they actually use on the curbside, on street side parking, as opposed to marked parking spaces that have a fixed price. So if someone has a very compact car that takes up very little of the curbside, they pay less. If they have the big SUV, they may pay more.
Right. So all those people out there driving the smart car, you're in for a treat because you're going to be paying less for your parking.
Perhaps.
Right.
Perhaps.
Yeah,
but what about the smart car, the driverless car? Can we get into that a bit?
Well, the smart car, I'm thinking that, there's small, if you've seen those ones,
trademark, the name,
yeah,
smart
the smart car. The little one. But the driverless car, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So just wanted a lot of coverage from some of the research that's been done. And obviously, Google had the brand recognition, but we know that BMW and Mercedes, a lot of other manufacturers obviously looking at this function. What can you give us a sense of what's actually going into, what sort of technology is being required to go into that sort of product?
So there's sort of two main thrusts, okay? One is, as you mentioned earlier, sensors. And sensors are all around us now, and now more sophisticated sensors are being built into vehicles. Radar, ultrasonic sensors, night vision video type sensors, heat sensors for animals and whatnot crossing the road. But one thing that's around the corner that the government, federal government, is pushing quite a bit is this dedicated short range communication channel, DSRC. And here, this supports very sophisticated vehicle to vehicle and vehicle to infrastructure communication. What that means is when the guy in front of you on the highway slams on his brakes and it's one car in front of you, let's say, so you really can't see them,
yep.
Well, that information instantaneously will get broadcast to the local area so that your vehicle itself may give you an indication, may shake the steering wheel or give another indication that, hey, something's happening. You better be careful. You might want to slow down. This is seen as perhaps giving a sort of bringing a revolution in car safety and safety on the roadway.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, Ken.
Sorry, if I could build on Peter's response in terms of the range of things then that lead us to autonomous vehicles, which is where you started.
Yep.
Right. So sensors in the car is kind of the first step. Can I tell what's happening around me?
Yeah.
The next step is what action do I take now that I know what's happening around me?
Right.
So in some cases, as Peter mentioned, you might have a vibrating seat, which is just an indication to the driver to take the action.
Right.
But then all the way down the road is the autonomous vehicle, where it actually doesn't ask the driver to do anything. The car is in control. The car actually decides when to apply the brakes, when to steer, and all of the controls. And so it's building the range of things from sensing all the way through to full control, and there are steps in between along the way.
So is that a space that Xerox wants to be in or is in?
So the way we position our research sort of leverages off our current businesses. So one thing with the driverless car and in general, our tolling businesses will be affected, you know. And, you know, what exactly is tolling with a driverless car? Is it the same as we do today? Is it different? People also are talking about not only driverless cars, but cars being able to join virtual convoys, where vehicles can sort of be virtually connected together using their sensors and communication.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have this sort of virtual road train that may go from Rochester to Cleveland. Some people who are going to Buffalo may join that road train, but then get off at Buffalo. So how does that affect our tolling business, for example, or parking or other businesses?
Right. So if you're talking about aggregating users in a different way through these systems, how would that – so you're sort of thinking it on that level. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess I'm interested in – we haven't talked a lot about some of the other – we know that there's going to be a major announcement by President Obama on Monday about measures to deal with carbon emissions and so on. So could you talk a little bit about how you're reading, you know, the issue around, and we know that, you know, vehicle emissions are a massive issue, and how the technology is working to address some of that?
You know, I'd point back to the HOT lanes and other, you know, carpooling lanes for congestion management. That's sort of one major way that we're investigating today, and also we can go back to the parking and driver congestion and parking. You know, we also have a large business in sort of mass transit, ticketing machines, and other, you know, subways and bus, for example, and making those systems easier to use. You know, when you book a trip, let's say on one of the you know, booking sites for travel, you know, typically you book your hotel and your flight. But, you know, getting from one place to another, either, you know, through multimodal means of, you know, you get on a subway. But then, you know, when you're in a subway station, and if I'm in New York, I don't always know when I'm in the station, which door am I supposed to get out of the station to get me to walk a couple blocks
to connect
and get on
with
a bus.
The bus.
Exactly.
Is going to take you, what?
Exactly.
The, yep.
So
right.
Information systems are emerging that will give you that information in real time.
Right. Sure.
Interesting. Our guests for this half hour of Connections Innovation Friday, Kenneth Mihailov and Peter Paul. From the Xerox Research Center in Webster. If you want to join the show, the number is 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. It's interesting, just looking at what's being added to cars in terms of the sensors and things that we've talked about, it seems like it's incrementally leading to that autonomous vehicle with the blind spot monitoring, pedestrian detection, adaptive cruise control, forward collision warning, lane departure warning, and all those things. I mean, it seems like that's pretty obvious to you guys. Is it?
I think that's where we're going. I think Google clearly has a position that they're staking on this. I think that it's not anything that's going to happen in the next few years, probably, but we're seeing certainly signs that are moving in that direction. I think for Xerox, what we're looking for is the kind of technologies that Peter mentioned before that allow the communication between the vehicles and the communication with the surrounding areas.
Mm-hmm.
There may be ways that we can enhance, improve the services we provide today, and maybe there are new services that will come out of that we can identify. And so part of our work is one of the announcements I think you have is around our relationship with the University of Michigan.
Right.
And the Mobility Transformation Center there. Their goal, as previously announced, was to really look over the next 10 to 20 years at what the future of mobility should be.
Right.
And we're now a leadership partner member with University of Michigan's Mobility Transformation Center in looking at those kinds of things.
Right. And they're building a 30-acre simulated city just to develop this?
Right.
That's got to be real exciting.
It's very exciting. Very exciting.
Well, and they're soliciting, you know, the public in that area. I think it's 20,000 vehicles to have sort of special onboard units, sort of like a super GPS unit, you could think of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, inside the car that would not only perform the function of GPS, but perform the functions, as I mentioned, of the vehicle-to-vehicle communication and the vehicle-to-infrastructure.
Right. So there's just to help our listeners visualize, so it's kind of a constructed campus. And what's the really the what are the kind of core objectives, I guess, of the building of the campus and your relationship with the University of Michigan?
So the real objectives of that campus that they're building is to take some of these technologies that we've talked about, implement them in some number of vehicles, and actually test them. It comes from a history that the University of Michigan has had with its Transportation Research Institute,
yep.
which for decades has been involved in traffic safety and vehicle safety. So for a number of years, they've built that kind of skill and that kind of history, and now they're moving from the safety aspect out into how do we make mobility better and more satisfactory for everyone. So they're really trying to put together all of the different kinds of scenarios you might find in a normal environment in a city. You have intersections of certain types. You have situations where a car comes and is blocked by a building.
Right.
So can the technologies work if they have to communicate around corners? You'll have traffic lights, and part of the goal would be perhaps to control traffic lights in certain ways. You may want to allow an emergency vehicle to pass through a traffic in a certain way, and the way the cars can communicate might allow that more effectively. So they're thinking through all those different scenarios that you might have in a typical urban environment, and they want to build the capabilities to test all of those things. Our role really there is to help look at those things and see where our opportunities are given the data and the information that's being shared as a result.
Right.
In safety applications, you know, it's really all about statistics. So you need a large body of people acting in their natural way to really understand, are these applications really going to be proved out or not?
Right.
That's I think, one of the goals as
right.
well. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
This is all, a lot of this is about safety in addition to, you know, increased efficiencies and economies and carbon and all that. Are we going to be trading some risk factors for new risk factors? In other words, in a lot of ways, it will be fewer accidents in terms of changing the lane when there's someone in your blind spot. But just thinking of all the variables, you overlook one, and all you know what could break loose. Does that keep you up at night ever?
Certainly, I think about public policy in general. It's sort of you sort of make trade-offs for the whole system to be more efficient. And that is one of the issues. Typically in these kind of systems, there's lots of different self-checks and diagnostics and fail-safes and whatnot so that the system itself can know when a sensor is failing or not working properly or whatnot. And I think there will be definitely regulations to have those things in place.
Yeah.
I think in addition, we've certainly heard some things that relate to an autonomous vehicle may decide that it is losing control and revert the control back to a driver. So there may be options that allow you to take back manual control in a situation where the electronics and the software that drive the car aren't perhaps working as well as they should. So as Peter said, there are going to be fail-safes that allow that to work properly. I'm sure that there'll be enough testing to make sure that we're not making the wrong kind of trade-offs here.
Well, right. And then that's part of the reason for this institute in the first place was kind of like the Institute for Highway Safety, the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety.
Exactly.
It's about saving lives but also saving insurance money. In terms of getting all this data, because you need a lot of data like you're talking about, is there ever a thought of just allowing people the option of putting sensors in their vehicle and you pay them, you know, a little bit of money and they can just do whatever they do, drive, you know, and then just see what you get?
So, in fact, the situation that the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute just has finished first phase one of and is implementing phase two of is exactly that. When they were trying to do the first pass at testing some of these connected vehicle technologies, they went out and they went to the public and looked for volunteers, and they provided the technology to them and based for a small fee to help them involved. They had way more volunteers than they had capacity to fill the pipeline in terms of the testing. So they've done exactly what you just described.
Huh, interesting. And now you're crunching the numbers.
We're preparing to. That's part of the data that we want to get access to as a result of our engagement with them, and we're working through the details of how to actually start that process.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Do you link into existing black boxes, so-called black boxes that are in, I guess most new vehicles now have some sort of data collection and retention system that you need a special license to open up and look at or whatever?
I think at this point, probably we ourselves won't be getting into the black boxes directly, but the people that we would be working with have more of those connections to do that. That may change in that some of our partners in the Mobility Transformation Center are in the auto industry.
Right.
And so there may be new opportunities like that. But at this point, I think the data that we're looking for first is going to come from our university partners, and then we'll work with that data. We'll see where that takes us.
One principle that we use across our businesses in terms of instrumentation of real-world systems is you sort of don't want to affect the operation of what that system is intended for.
Hmm.
So a lot of times, at least initially, you would have sort of a separate parallel system to do that kind of data collection. But eventually, once the sort of data collection's proved out, doesn't affect things, certainly could be instrumented that way.
Right. Interesting.
Yep.
What else would our listeners want to know about? I mean, you're doing some amazing stuff, and we only have a short time, but what else would you want to let us know about what you're doing?
So we talked about the University of Michigan relationship. Another relationship that we've established over the last year or two here has been with the Center for Urban Science and Progress in New York City. This is an organization that started out of New York University, and it has industry partners, academic partners, and New York City agency partners, transportation being one of those sets of agencies. And its goal is to, again, look at the data that the city generates through all of its normal operations and try to understand how to provide better services for the city's citizens as a result of that. So it's a data-based approach. New York City becomes a living lab,
right.
So we can go in there and we can collect that data out of the city. We can use the city operations to test new opportunities that we come up with. So we're also associated with that organization and are in the process of defining the right kinds of projects to work together with on that.
Right. So I think transport ticket data is one thing that you're looking into, and how you generate meaningful sets of information about that. I mean, I could see implications for disaster preparedness, for one thing, mm-hmm. would be an application for that kind of stuff. So I just wanted to ask a general question about, I guess there's been a little bit of a thread in today's program just around collaborations and how you develop ideas and build, you know. So how significant are those collaborations when you're back up in Webster in the lab, thinking through your ideas? You know, is it important that you're checking in with those partners or collaborators to sort of field test some of these ideas as you kind of move forward with them?
It's very important. It's critical. I think we look at both those kinds of partners and our customers as the way that we do that. We clearly won't get the right answer if all we're doing is sitting in the lab. And so we actually try to spend a lot of time working with clients and customers and talk about how they see the world and what things that will be important to them, what opportunities they have, what pain points they have. And we have a process that we call a dreaming session where we sit down with them and we go through this. And it provides a couple of benefits. One, they have the opportunity to really impact our research direction by providing that kind of input. For us, it gives us face-to-face exposure to our clients and our customers. We can test ideas. We can learn things. It's really quite beneficial in helping us make sure that we stay on the right track. Clearly, the collaborations with the people that we've talked about will provide similar kind of benefits. So it's very important to get out of the labs and into the world to do this.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Peter, did you have a thought?
Yeah, perhaps you had talked earlier in your show, your earlier show on innovation. So one of the things we talk about in our research center is open innovation.
Mm-hmm.
That's innovation with these collaborative partners. You know, all the smartest people don't work for you. The old days of the closed research center with the dark curtains.
The Bell Labs
and
the, thing, whatever.
Yeah, that's no longer the case. In fact, we're really encouraged to seek out those partnerships of where data is available, where real-world problems are can be discussed.
Right, sure. Yeah.
And I would add one more thing here, and that is I think we're our labs, what we call our labs now, are different than they used to be. Right? We go out into the world to actually do the testing. We've done a lot of testing. Peter personally has done a lot of testing in the Webster area and the Rochester area, looking at traffic systems flowing past.
Right.
So you got to get out into the world in these services spaces.
Well, this was just a final topic I wanted to touch on was looking at the role of urban design and the other sort of environmental factors that are out there that you have to deal with. So you're kind of dropping a product into a built environment, say in Rochester's downtown or whatever. I assume adaptability or being able to adapt to different conditions is a really a critical part of your business model or sustainability model, that there's some adaptive, you know, ability to respond to different environments, and presumably as, you know, say streetscapes change, that you're going to need to be able to respond to them as well.
Absolutely, and we build in that intelligence often in the systems to sort of auto-calibrating, self-calibrating, quick setups in different environments. Yeah, it's definitely a factor in our development.
Now, this is all very exciting. We're going to have them back to see what's going on, mm-hmm, because you've got a lot going on. That's Peter Paul and Kenneth Mihailov from the Xerox Research Center in Webster. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks
here.
Thanks for being with us. Thank
on,
you.
Glad to be here. Connections Glad Innovation Friday. Great. Have a great weekend. I want to hear more about those dreaming sessions at some point. Sounds pretty interesting. All right. We'll be back in a minute. I'm Frank Sigelski, and you are listening to Connections Innovation Friday on WXXI AM, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org. Continuing on WXXI Innovation Friday Connections, I'm Frank Sigelski, and for the next half hour, we're going to speak with Stephen Butler, and he is from Engage CNY. Let's get him right on the phones here. He's been waiting patiently. Mr. Butler, thank you very much for joining us on Innovation Friday on Connections.
Hello, thanks for having me.
And Stephen, you're Executive Director of CNY Arts, and we're here to talk about Engage CNY, which is an initiative to try and get some traction and communication between arts organizations, specifically in central New York, where they're viewing to boosting visitors, providing economic benefits, and also outcomes in community. Do you want to sort of outline what you guys are thinking of?
Absolutely. We are contracted by the state of New York through the New York State Council on the Arts to serve six counties, and those include Oswego, Onondaga, Cortland, Herkimer, Madison, and Oneida. And when we were given that contract, or the increased size of that area, which is about 5,500 square miles, it occurred to us that before we, as a trade association, as an art service organization, that before we provided services or direction for a region of that size, it would be really good to do a regional assessment of what was going on. And more importantly, as long as we were going to do a regional assessment, why not look at to see if we could accomplish creating a regional cultural plan that a variety of stakeholders, both on the supply side of those providing arts, culture, and heritage offerings, as well as the demand side, what the general public and community leaders who have other agendas often would like to see happen, where was their convergence, where was their commonality, and how could we work together to create, you know, vitality in the region?
Right. Are all art and cultural organizations in the six county area, are they all included? Is this something you have to sign up for if you have a museum somewhere, or how does that work?
Well, we conducted a year-long survey, public survey, with a lot of leader, what we call leadership advisors, who were pushing the survey to the general public, you know, through their mechanisms in all of these six counties. And we wrote, you know, of course, through email and other mechanisms to the arts and culturals that we were aware of. And we got about 110 arts and culture organizations to respond, over 500 individual artists to respond, and over 7,000 general public responses. And I have to tell you that for an opinion survey for arts and entertainment, that's really quite a huge response rate. As well, we held over 50 focus groups and forums, and, you know, interviewed another 500 individuals about their thoughts about the questions that we were asking. But I do want to point out, because you asked, is every organization in? As we did our research, just by scanning websites, we determined that there are at least 715 cultural providers in this region, and over 1,600 individual artists. So while we got a good sampling, we have not certainly tapped into everybody's thoughts about this project.
Right. Hmm. And I mean, just to give people a sense of the scope of it, I mean, there's just while you were talking, Stephen, I'm just looking over this, really a massive collection of data on one level, just capturing all kinds of opinions around what people's perceptions of central New York are generally, the kind of demographic information, what sort of understanding people have about what creative, you know, entertainment activities are in their region, and so on. So what did you want to do when you started to crunch down all of that raw information out of the surveys? You know, what were you, you know, how are you looking to then leverage that information?
Well, you know, we engaged in this process, if you will, because we were trying to find out, you know, a few different things, in terms of, you know, our questions, and those were, what opportunities do residents in the six counties want? What exists to respond to what they want? And in what other regional agendas could arts and culture play a supportive role? And then finally, what would successful regional cultural development require in terms of infrastructure and sustainability? So we went into this process hoping to get answers to those four questions. And we found out, I mean, quite a bit of information through this opinion poll. It certainly, you know, would be important leads as to how the general public and the arts and cultural organizations and heritage sites are thinking. But one thing I want to say right up front is we, you know, well over 80% of the respondents, through their answers, said that they really highly value arts and culture in the region. And they think that it plays important roles in terms of building bridges between cultural divides, which could be, you know, geographic, urban, rural, suburban, economic, ethnicity. So there's a huge interest in arts and culture in the region. The second thing that we learned is that people think it's really easy to find out about what's happening in terms of arts, culture, and heritage in the region. And the third thing that's really interesting is that when you said, but how much do you really know about it, that number dropped well below 50%. It was 27% said, I actually know a lot. So there's a kind of a disconnect. And, you know, from the study and that result, we're looking at that very intensely now. And we'll probably go back and do some gap analysis to find out if you value it, if you think it's easy to find, why is there a sort of a lack of knowledge about what's really here?
Right. Sorry, just to jump in, Stephen, is part of your agenda, too, also obviously to make the cultural activity, the providers, also fully informed about what level of understanding and knowledge people have about the activities that they're doing?
Well, yes, exactly. You're exactly right in that. And not only that, but how when we ask people, you know, could you sort of rank, you know, do you find the arts and cultural and heritage offerings excellent, good, okay, bad, you know, or no response whatsoever, don't even care enough to respond, I think there was some interesting information there in terms of, you know, age, ethnicity, and education as to how people respond to what's being offered. So clearly, for our arts and culturals, we want their offerings. We want to give them as much information so that they can get the word out and better know how to direct that message, but also that their offerings have relevance to the populations that are here in this region.
What are some of the arts, cultural, heritage offerings that folks might overlook?
Well, I think that, you know, if you are in Onondaga County, you might not be aware of some of the festivals taking place in Herkimer. You know, you're just not going to be aware of that. Or you might not be aware of a heritage site that's very important to Herkimer County's history, but not necessarily important to your local history.
Mm-hmm.
And by actually bringing all this information together for people that are interested in heritage, you could actually begin to work collaboratively with both the tourism agencies as well as those the entities offering these heritage sites to say, why not work together and create a corridor of heritage, you know, a heritage trail, some of which is being done. But there's just always more to know. You know, one of the first things, this is sort of interesting, but when we went into Oswego, some of the first people we talked to said, how come Onondaga County schedules their Arts Week Festival at the same time we do Harbor Fest? And that really turned out to be, you know, in finding out the answer to that question, it turned out that the Arts and Crafters are also on a circuit, and this is the week that they come into Onondaga County, so that's the week that it got scheduled for, and it's been that way, you know, ever since. And we went back and said, is there a way to collaboratively say, let's get people to attend both of these festivals rather than one or the other?
And this is certainly an issue once the weather gets good, where everyone says, right, it's June, let's just program our festivals in, you know, June or July or whatever. So part of that's clearly communication. And it sounds like as well, I'm just thinking of the kinds of very, very strong informal knowledge networks that exist, say, amongst people who are into model railways or into, well, it's a theatre organs or into, you know, antique book presses or whatever. They have their own existing sort of networks of when the trade fairs are on or, you know, where these specialist little museums or whatever. But part of it's just kind of, I imagine, is tapping into some of those really, really specialist collectives of knowledge as well.
Absolutely. It's, you know, the word you use, networks, I think is really key here, because I think it's actually, you know, tapping into that knowledge and building a new kind of network that's more encompassing, so that as the general public comes to, we have a social marketing system, go to cnyarts.org, and our goal is to really provide comprehensive information so that people, rather than finding this information through, you know, eclectic networks or in various sources, can go to one site and find really comprehensive information about what's happening in the region. And then we really hope to work with other media to share that information for their calendars, because our goal is to get more eyes on calendars and, you know, publicizing of culture and heritage events.
Okay. Our guest for this portion of Connections Innovation Friday is Stephen Butler, Executive Director of Engage CNY, talking about Central New York and the arts. What about categories of information? Just sitting here as we're talking, I think there are some things that are annual festivals, and then you have things that are year-round and things that are maybe on different types of schedules, some things that involve food, some durable goods. Are you categorizing all these different offerings at this point, or is that a goal?
In the social marketing system, people actually sort of self-describe, what category that they fall into. For the purposes of the study, we actually asked people what they enjoyed most, and then those were handwritten answers in many cases. So we had to, you know, consolidate that data under categories, and we came up with 10. One was live music concerts, for instance, and I'm bringing that up because when the question was asked, you know, what do you enjoy most, concerts and live music far outpaced almost every other form of art and entertainment. And about 40% was their most favorable, and the next one was camping, fishing, and hunting at 27%. But I'm happy to say that theater, musicals, movies and film, festivals, and reading all made it into the top 10.
Is there a sense that maybe folks are overlooking categories of things that, you know, that they're not exploring? We all consider and off the top of our heads think, yeah, I like live music, I like concerts, I like festivals, I like the museum, but I don't know what I don't know, and your constituents are the same way.
Well, I think that's true. And I also wonder if a lot of people are much more, participate much more in the art, but they don't define it in the arts and heritage events, but they don't particularly define it as that. So if they go to the park on the 4th of July and there's music being played, you know, they're there for the 4th of July and art is part of that experience. Music is part of that experience, but they may not perceive it as being an artistic, participating in an artistic offering or a cultural experience. heritage offering. They're there in the park because they're going to there's going to be you know, barbecue chicken, and they're bringing the kids, you know, et cetera.
And there's beer.
Yum. And there's food.
And food. And you know what? There, I think there's real room for opportunity. Food came up very high. You know, various local recipes, chicken riggies in Utica, you know, Utica greens, you know, salt potatoes, things that are key to the region. And I think there's a real opportunity for the arts and culturals to work with the food industry a lot more than it currently does. And it does a fair amount, but to blend food and art in events.
So just to talk about the economic and the kind of, you know, because the what your aspirations for this information are, you've written a regional cultural plan to boost the livability and economic vitality of Central New York over a 10-year period. So that's a pretty big, broad goal to have. How do you see this understanding of cultural activities helping to boost two really, really key indicators, livability and economic vitality?
Yes. Well, let's start with economic vitality a little bit and talk about and go back to the comment about, you know, the point about networking. You know, truthfully, in a way, although individual artists often work alone, if you add everybody together, the sum is greater than its parts. We really represent a pretty strong industry. And there's no doubt that people working in arts, culture, and heritage, you know, demonstrate a fair amount of creativity and innovation. And these are the kind of people that you know, in one sense, that you definitely want to retain in your region. You want to give them reasons to continue to live and work in the region, which is really very affordable, maybe perhaps why they have chosen to be here in some sense. So I think that it helps to retain and attract a creative, vibrant, innovative workforce. We also know through other studies that have been done with the Americans for the Arts that peripheral spending by audience members, in addition to any tickets that they buy, generally is about $25 per person for each event that they go to, between dinner, gas, parking garages, babysitters, haircuts, new clothes, all of that. So every time people are going out and engaging in an arts and cultural activity, they're spending a lot of additional money in the hospitality industries and other areas that generate sales tax that come back to local and state governments. So we really are an economic driver in that way. In Syracuse alone, the study showed that, you know, the industry itself, you know, drops close to $35 million into the local economy because arts and culture is so very labor-intensive and, you know, really a huge demand for supplies such as paint, lumber, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And there's also the ripple effects of people who go to an event like that and then say, okay, now we're going to the Finger Lakes and then we're going to the George Eastman
right.
House or whatever.
Right. And that, yes, and this is just local participation. We haven't even gotten into room occupancy tax of people who are like, well, now that I'm here, let's stay or let's come back and stay for a few days because there's all these other things that I want to do.
Right.
I think in terms of livability, we know that there have been a lot of studies that have been done that as people decide where they want to live and work, that they look to see that there's robust cultural activity. It's one of the deciders and one of the things, one of the key factors in how a community is rated as being livable. And I know that for hospitals and universities, colleges that are looking to attract the best talent, researchers and medical professionals, they want to know that they can point to those that they're trying to recruit, that there is a wealth of activity, you know, in addition to sports and the landscape and our wonderful park system, that there's also these cultural amenities of very robust, very vigorous cultural activities that they can participate in.
Yeah, fantastic. Stephen Butler is Executive Director of CNY Arts, Engage CNY. If you want to join the show, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Stephen, do you work with other organizations outside of yours to, again, further coordinate all of this that you're trying to do, public or private?
Yes, CNY Arts is one of the arts councils, regional or local, that are spread around New York State, and we work together and meet on a semi-regular basis to try to talk about what we're seeing, you know, in the environment and collaborate on responses to what we're seeing in the environment. We also work at the direction, as I said before, of the New York State Council on the Arts, which is also making a huge push behind cultural planning, both locally and regionally. So I think these efforts, you know, do have legs. As well, we have relationships and that are beginning or with convention and visitor bureaus, because the information that we're gathering about these cultural offerings, they would like to have so that they can create packages and better inducements to bring visitors into our region.
Because you need to be speaking to those markets, like New York City, for example, where people are looking to, you know, to then extend their stay or to have an alternative experience, and so on.
Absolutely. Or, you know, coming down from Canada,
yep.
You know, and, you know, to maybe do some shopping, but maybe they'll stay for a couple of days because there's a great exhibit at the museum, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, right. Promote the arts and you promote the region, and that helps the economy and so on and so forth. Regarding the economy, has there been a lot of change? Maybe this is a little bit off topic, but, you know, since 2007, 2008, have you had to deal with any of the ramifications of that economic slowdown? I'll just call it that for now.
Absolutely, our very valuable symphony in Syracuse, the Syracuse Symphony Orchestra, went out of business.
Mm.
It declared bankruptcy, and you know you saw that story repeated in many other cities throughout the nation. And there, a new symphony is emerging with a totally different model, as a cooperative, where the musicians have, you know, a stake in the game for how that. That organization is developing. We also know from our survey that those that responded, of the 110, a third said that they no longer have a marketing person at their organization, and not quite as many said that they don't have any marketing dollars. So when we're talking about outreach and promotion, there's a capacity need in these arts and culturals to have more funds to be allocated to those purposes.
So you do the marketing for them?
Well,
I mean, maybe that doesn't sound right, but something like that.
Essentially, you've got to centralize those things. We're out of time. Thanks very much for joining us, Stephen Butler, Executive Director of CNY Arts. And the documents that we've been talking about today, cnyarts.org, cnyarts.org. You can go and have a look at the whole Engage CNY cultural plan. Thanks for having me on, Frank.
Oh, thanks.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Okay, thanks, Stephen.
Thanks,
Stephen. And that's Matt Leonard is the... editor of the Innovation Trail Reporting Project. I'm Frank Sigelski, and you have been listening to Innovation Friday on Connections on WXXI AM, WEOS, the WXXI mobile app, and WXXINews.org.